History through the eyes of those who lived it. This is Hometown Heroes, presented on the air and online by Provident Payments, proudly honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the program that reminds you no matter where you live in this great country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, there are stories there that should not go untold. And they don't have to go untold, as long as we're willing to take the initiative to ask a few questions and then invest a little time to patiently listen as memories from long ago start to rise to the surface once more. We want to honor our veterans for their service and sacrifice. We want to preserve their stories so we never forget the price that's been paid for our freedom. And in that process, not only are we educated, not only are we entertained, but so often we end up inspired by these stories from our greatest generation. Today's program will focus on an 80th anniversary that snuck past with relatively little fanfare last week. In fact, you may not even have heard a mention of it, but I'm talking about the Bataan Death March, when perhaps as many as 80,000 American and Filipino prisoners, most of whom had already been starving, were forced to march more than 60 miles, with thousands dying along the way and thousands more dying later in captivity. Most of those fortunate enough to survive the death march had to wait more than 3 years before they would taste freedom again. After World War II, some of the Japanese officers orchestrating the death march were tried for war crimes and sentenced to death. It is an ugly chapter of history, but one that should never be forgotten. And we've been blessed over the years to meet several men who survived that horrific ordeal. 80th anniversary commemorations were held last week in places like Albuquerque, New Mexico, where Bataan Memorial Park was a place the locals gathered during the war to update each other on the status of loved ones. New Mexico had more men on the death march, nearly 2,000, than any other state. The USS Hornet Museum in Alameda, California is another place where descendants of Death March survivors and descendants of Death March victims gathered this last week to honor their legacy. And, you know, there are a couple nonprofit organizations that work year-round in preserving this specific kind of history. If you head over to hometownheroesradio.com, I have links for you to both the Bataan Legacy Project and the Bataan Corregidor Memorial Foundation of New Mexico. Throughout this episode today, you'll hear memories from men who were there when the Bataan Death March began and were in the Philippines when World War II began for America. We're going to start with Bud Kirchhoff, a native of Illinois who had joined the National Guard in 1936 and had arrived in the Philippines right around Thanksgiving in 1941 with the 192nd Tank Battalion. Pearl Harbor and those installations in Hawaii weren't the only targets struck by the Japanese on December 7th, 1941.
Well, we got bombed the same day. Clark Field was a mess. You know, all the planes were landed and they were sitting ducks.
Sitting ducks, yeah. Destroyed.
Mm-hmm. Then they had dive bombers behind the high-level bombers, and I was only 100 yards from Clark Field when it was bombed. So we were vulnerable, especially in the dive bombers, which were also strafing and things like that. So,
what did that feel like? What went through your mind when you saw these planes coming in and everything's blowing up in front of your eyes?
Well, I don't know that you could say you think. You just react. You just do what you have to do. In fact, we had one lieutenant, he was running from the scene. He dove into a slit trench. Well, a slit trench is where you, in lieu of a bathroom, if you... That's how you react to things like that. I didn't because, but he did, and kind of a nervous reaction or knee-jerk reaction or whatever. Well, at least he didn't get hit.
Yeah. He went from a sticky situation to a stinky situation, yeah. But he survived. Good for him. What was the reaction of you and your fellow troops? Was there anti-aircraft fire? Are you trying to shoot any of these guys down, or are you completely off guard?
Well, no. Corregidor had a lot of anti-aircraft. We had some, but not anywhere near. You could see when the bombers came over, our anti-aircraft was First World War stuff. We didn't have any modern equipment at all, and it would only go up so far, and the planes knew that. And we right above it, you could see them coming in, and all the black where the anti-aircraft was going on, and the planes were just above that. We had antiquated equipment, let's face it. After the First World War, our Congress, in their great wisdom, decided that we didn't need any defense anymore. So they had cut our military down to nothing. And then at the beginning of the Second World War, they had trucks that they were had signs on us, tanks and, you know, and maneuvers and wood guns and all that stuff. They were real. Mm-hmm. And we actually had those. Not us. We had Thompson subs and sidearm. And I was standing in the road, and some truck started coming roaring by. I got out of there, and I stopped him. He was going to go by, so I pulled my gun out. I said, "I want to, you know, stop." And I got on this truck, and we all left there in a hurry.
Pulled a gun on your own guy to get him to give you a ride?
Yeah, I did that.
Uh-huh. Well, I'm glad that he stopped.
I am too.
I bet. And then what? Where did you guys go from there, and when did you realize we're in some pretty big trouble here?
Well, what happened was that right after the bombing took place, not right after, but a few days later, they had a landing party at Lingayen Gulf. That's where the Japanese landed. Our group went up there. I wasn't in that particular action because I was on detached service to the MPs. And so when they finally got back there, and then I left the MPs because I didn't need them anymore, and I got back in a tank again. But that was where the actual land fighting started, was Lingayen Gulf, and they moved gradually back to where we all that could get there were in Bataan, and that's where the peninsula of Bataan, and that's where we retreated to. And we defended there for, April 9th, we surrendered. So I think 4 months that we were actually in combat mode.
How intense was that? Did you spend most of that inside a tank? Or where
good,
were you?
Good part of it, yeah.
Did that make you feel fairly safe, or did you feel like you were a target?
Actually, they aren't safe. Mm-hmm. they're not safe but a tank, because they're the first object of their try to destroy, see. So a jungle is no place for tank warfare, let me tell you. So we were kind of hamstrung in the tank warfare and the infantry. So then, April 9th, we surrendered, and I got a little story. I was still in my tank when we surrendered.
Uh-huh. Did you know that was coming? Did you have a pretty good idea that this was going to happen?
We knew that we were surrendered. We weren't really, what do you call it? Anyway, we surrendered as a whole entity,
right?
A whole group, which was different than just surrendering as an individual or group, small group. So they had us burn our tanks, to butt plates off the guns, and open the gas tanks. And we had aircraft engine fuel in there, so, it burned in a hurry. Anyway, we all got in this truck, and we were going back to where we were getting together anyway.
Mm-hmm.
And somebody didn't tell the Japanese that we had surrendered. So here come two Zero fighters strafing, and you never saw a truck empty so fast in all your life.
Holy cow.
Yeah, they were straight. I don't know if anybody, I didn't get hit. I guess a couple of them got hit. So then I didn't go back to that truck again. I wandered through the woods until I got to our group. So we're sitting alongside the road, and the major in charge of maintenance came along and said, "Hey, any of you guys want to come with me?" And I said, "Where are you going?" He said, "We're going back to the maintenance department and get some clothing and canteens, and if there's any food, we'll bring it back." So I went with him, another fellow, there were three of us. So there's a beautiful blue Buick, about a 1939 or 1940. So we took all the stuff that we had collected and put it in the trunk and in the back seat. And we were driving back, and I was driving, and all of a sudden a little got out in front of us, and he stopped. And so he said, "Follow me," or didn't say it. He just motioned.
Mm-hmm.
We wandered over under a huge tree that must have been an 8-foot trunk or 10-foot trunk of the tree, and it was like a house under there. Was heavy branches were 10, 15 feet wide on each side. Under this tree is sitting a guy in a beautiful white uniform. It was a general.
A Japanese general. Uh-huh.
Yeah. And so we figured we're dead ducks. We were stealing their stuff because they owned it now that we were surrendered to them. All that guy wanted was the car. And I don't blame him. He's a general. He's right to entitled to a private vehicle.
Brand new, nice-looking American car.
Oh, yeah, it was. Yeah. Yeah. So anyway, we figured we were going to get shot for sure. But only when we had to take all this stuff out of this car and carry it back to where we were stationed on the long side of the road. So that was one of those things that was funny but it could have been deadly. So, you know,
it's funny now. It wasn't funny then.
No, that's right. The worst part about the death march was the debilitating effects of the lack of food for the last 4 months, small amounts of food that we had, and just being in the Philippines. Now, like I say, we were only there for 18 days before the war started, so we weren't even acclimated to the difference between being in Chicago and being in Manila.
You were fighting for 4 months after the war started, but the supplies weren't getting to you. So you.
That's correct. We were using up what we were cannibalizing what we had. It wasn't going to be very long before we didn't have anything. There had been a directive come down to fight to the end, and this general who surrendered us, General King, said he wasn't going to do that. And so he surrendered us to the Japanese. And that's, of course, when they moved us out of Bataan into Camp O'Donnell. More men died in the Camp O'Donnell than they did on the march. And the reason for that, by then, their reserves strength had been exhausted to a point where they were too vulnerable to everything, any disease. I got diphtheria, among other things. Diphtheria is a dangerous thing. It's very high, you know, high temperature and stuff like that. So, and I was the last one in the group to get a toxin antitoxin, which is what you fight diphtheria with. See, so it was. Touch and go there for a while for me. So then we were moved from O'Donnell to Camp Anadawan. And, of course, most people have heard of that now because they had that ghost soldier story about...
That's right, the Great Raid.
Yeah, I went to Japan in 1943, Omuta, which is at Fukuoka area, and we were coal mining.
So you were on the Bataan Death March. Then you're in two different camps in the Philippines and three more camps in Japan. You filled up the entire POW bingo card in the Pacific.
Well, I tried.
Easy to laugh about it now. Well, I want to underscore, during that time, before you were captured, you had no supplies. You're cannibalizing, as you say, your own equipment. Went so far as to eat the horses of the cavalry?
Yeah, the 26th Cavalry had, I don't know how many horses, but they were used for food. They weren't going anywhere anyway, so, you know, I might as well eat them rather than just destroy them or give them to the Japs.
And then once you were on the march and then in those camps, you probably would have given anything to have a horse to eat because you weren't eating anything
little
close.
Horse jerky or not like not beef jerky, but horse jerky. We didn't have any of that either. So.
And you had entered the service. A strapping young Chicago boy of 200 pounds?
About 210.
Anyway. 210. After the march, how much did you weigh?
Well, at the end of the march, when I had the pneumonia, I was about 100 pounds, a little under 100 pounds. Didn't quite get to the 100 mark. But then by at the end of the war, I was up to 128.
What kept you going through all that? Was it the interaction with your fellow prisoners? Was it a faith that grounded you? What kept you focused on someday this is going to be over? Because 3.5 years, that's a lot of days to try to keep hope alive and stay positive.
Well, I didn't have a philosophy, as you know, but I did, but I didn't know it. And I just did one day at a time. Just worried about that day because yesterday was gone and tomorrow ain't here yet. So I had the philosophy, if you want, of taking it one day at a time. And the fellows who didn't, that worried about what's going to happen and think about home and everything, they're the ones that didn't make it, see.
How often did that thought cross your mind, though, that this may be it? This may be the last day that I wake up. I don't know if I'll be here tomorrow.
You know, I never thought about that. Well, here I am. Actually, in Japan, we were treated better than we were in the Philippines. And when you're in a combat zone, you know, they take a little bit more liberty than they would back home, too. So.
But after all this time, 3.5 years as a prisoner of war, you've survived the march. You've been moved through five different prison camps. No end in sight. Finally, there is an end in sight. Talk to me about when you were liberated and when you knew that that was going to happen and what it felt like when you said, I'm a free man again. It's been a while.
Well, when right near the end of the war, we start to get glimmerings that it's happening. See, we had one day this is another place I was working, not in a coal mine, and we were sitting out in the sun. It was lunchtime, and a B-29 we didn't know what it was. It was a big airplane. It went floating by. Mm-hmm. And what they were doing is taking pictures. So they dropped into our camp a map showing where all the prison camps were on this map, so they knew where they were. Mm-hmm. In fact, we had that one camp I was in, the city that was next to it was blown out of, by the firebombing.
But they spared the camp because they knew where you were.
But they didn't hit the powerhouse, the electric, you know, where they make electricity, mm-hmm. because we were right next to it. And they didn't hit the power plant.
Because, that's where you're thankful for good intelligence, huh?
Yeah.
Because there were a lot of people that were on the other side of that equation. Collateral damage because the target was too important.
Yeah. Well, the firebombing in Japan, they keep bringing up the atomic bomb and how bad it was and everything. It was chump change compared to the firebombing. Man, they'd burned down a whole city mm-hmm. with their firebombs and no warning like they did with the atomic bomb. They said, we're going to drop an atomic bomb, get out of the way. There was no warning with the firebombing, and the firebombing is much more deadly than the atomic bomb was.
And thankfully, they missed you guys. Then you find out, August of 1945.
August of 45.
After the second bomb was dropped?
Yeah. And like I say, I was only 40 miles from Nagasaki when they dropped that second bomb. In fact, the camp I was in, actually, I had a very weird experience. Or unusual, maybe is a better word. After we were freed, they said, they came into camp, said, you're now free to go home and leave everything behind you don't need and stuff like that. Because they were dropping food and stuff to us.
But it seemed kind of too good to be true at that point? Like you thought that day would never come?
No, you know what? I thought, it's about time. That's all I thought.
Yeah, I guess so.
So we're in this camp, and this one is up in a mountainous area. There were two other guys. I said, let's go wander around Japan and see if we can find another camp and stuff like that. So we started to go out to camp, and a British major who was in charge of the camp said, hey, where are you guys going? We're leaving. He said, I'm in charge of this camp. You got to stay here. Well, we told him in no uncertain terms that we're leaving anyway. So mm-hmm. I and these two other fellas wander around Japan for a whole month. And we'd go from some prison camps. Some nights we'd stay right in town, lay out, sleep around the public square. We got hungry, we'd go to another camp and they'd have some food. And we spent a whole month wandering around Japan.
I want to hear what it felt like when you got back to the States.
We landed in Seattle. I flew from Okinawa to Clark Field, which we had left a few months ago.
Yeah,
before that.
You had been there when it got bombed by the Japanese December 7th. Okay.
So then we were on a passenger ship from India, and we arrived in Seattle October the 27th of 1945, exactly 4 years to the day that I left from San Francisco. When I got off the ship, I never really got all excited. In fact, they put us in a hospital train and took us to Clinton, Iowa, Schick General Hospital there, and mm-hmm. that's where we did our rehabilitation.
When your family saw you, did they recognize you?
Oh, well, yeah, but because by that time, I hate to say this, but I had gained about 100 pounds by the time I saw
you. Take it away, I'm bringing it right back. There you go. The number one thing that your experience as a POW taught you, what are you most thankful for from that entire experience that maybe has impacted the rest of your life?
Not to raise your expectations too high in life. Be who you are and don't try to be somebody else like too many people do. They try to extend themselves and are disappointed. And when I came back, I just got a job, went to work, and never paid much attention to it anymore. I had no flashbacks or things like that. I just, some of the guys did, couldn't, in fact, they couldn't even handle coming back home. Mm-hmm. It never bothered me a bit.
Bud Kirchhoff, survivor of the Bataan Death March and 3.5 years of captivity afterwards during World War II. It's time for our first break, but we'll hear memories from more men who were there when that infamous incident unfolded. This special edition of Hometown Heroes will be right back after this. Do you ever have those moments where you realize you've been settling for less than the best for far too long? Sometimes we just accept the status quo without looking around for better ways to do things. And I've got to tell you, when it comes to your money, I believe I found a better way with EECU. Take a look at myeecu.org and you'll see why. EECU is not a bank. It's a nonprofit credit union that's all about taking care of you, the member. That's one of the reasons EECU just keeps growing and growing. Close to 300,000 members now in 10 different California counties. Over 30,000 ATMs, free mobile banking. And what I really love is how EECU always goes above and beyond to serve the community. In 2013, the leadership and generosity of EECU helped establish Central Valley Honor Flight. More than 1,000 veterans now have gotten to see their memorials in Washington, D.C. for free. And that's just one example of the community involvement EECU takes oh so seriously. Pick up the phone and become a member today. 1-800-538-3328. That's 800-538-3328.
Proudly presented by Provident Payments, this is Hometown Heroes, celebrating everyday Americans who answer the call of duty.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes and a special episode marking 80 years since the Bataan Death March. Very, very few of the approximately 60 to 80,000 American and Filipino prisoners on the march are still with us today. In fact, all of the men whose memories you're hearing today have now moved on to the great beyond, a reality that underscores the urgency of capturing stories like these while we can. Wild Bill Begley was a 20-year-old radio operator from Kentucky who had gone to the Philippines with the 34th Pursuit Squadron. Like so many others, he was pressed into infantry duty after the Japanese landed, and he learned to do whatever it took to survive.
We had a saying, if it moves, eat it. If it stands still, we salute it. We ate monkeys and snakes, lizards, anything that walked, crawled, or flew. We ate. We were starving, actually. We ran out of food whenever General MacArthur sent word by General King for us to surrender. We didn't want to, none of us did, but that was the orders of the day. And we stacked up our rifles and went out to the road, and there's where the real terrible things happen. I was already in bad shape. I went from 180 pounds to about 110 approximately. And the reason is we didn't have any food. And like I said, if it moved, eat it. If it stood still, we always said salute it.
But then once you're on the march, you don't even have the opportunity to do that. If you get out of line, even if you stop to get a drink of water, you might get shot, you might get bayoneted, you might get decapitated. You saw all of those things happen, didn't you?
Yes, unfortunately, I witnessed all of that kind of stuff. I walked approximately about 100 miles, I suppose. It was a terrible ordeal because they didn't give us any rest. We couldn't get any water. I went on the march. I was on it about 10 days, approximately. And I didn't get any food, didn't get any water. Guys would drop out, and they'd try to help one another. And it was pitiful. If you stopped, they'd either shoot or bayonet you. They seemed to enjoy bayoneting more than anything else. The thing about it is they also got some women and children, unfortunately, and they wouldn't let them out. They finally did. Quite a few of the Philippine soldiers, they slept off into the forest, and if they got caught, they'd get shot if they are bayoneted. So you had to be careful. We stopped at one place. I think it was the town of San Fernando. They lectured us in Japanese. They had an interpreter that would tell us what he's saying. They said you'd be shot and you'd be bayoneted. You had do what they wanted to. And if you dared to get off the road, see a dirty ditch full of filthy water, a lot of guys would be desperate and they'd make a break for it. And they'd shoot them and bayonet them. It was pretty horrible. Later, when we made a stop, there's a bunch of Japanese officers who were drinking and enjoying themselves, and they'd taunt us. We did get to sit down. And every now and then they'd pick out 10 men, make them dig a hole in the ground. They would use their two-handed samurai sword, and they tried to first see if they could decapitate a guy with one lick.
And this is a living person standing in this hole they dug.
Yeah, they'd make you come to attention, and they'd walk away. Mm. Then later, they got tired of that because they got blood all over their uniforms and their equipment. So they decided to change it, and they lined us up about 10 again. You dig a hole, then they'd come around behind and shoot you in the back of the head. You'd fall in.
Mm.
That went on until they got tired. We walked day and night, no food, no water. It's a terrible ordeal. I remember in particular two incidents that still come to mind. There's a lady, we went through a little barrio, they call it, that's what, a town. She had a little boy about 3 years old. The thing about it was he stuck his finger up and said, V for victory. When he did, a Japanese guard happened to be close by, and he bayoneted the little feller. Mm. And he raised him up, and he tried to fling him off his bayonet, and his mother screamed. She ran out there, and she tried to cover him, and the guard bayoneted her, and she died right there. And one other particular incident that was kind of bad was two chaplains were going across the bridge along with the rest of us. And one of them decided, well, this is too much, and he jumped. And the other chaplain ran around and tried to get to him. And when he did, the guard motioned him back and didn't want to get to him, but he insisted. So he shot him, and then he bayoneted him. They died holding hands.
Hmm. Unbelievably horrific things that you witnessed, and I know that you endured, too. I know that you estimate you were bayoneted yourself 30 times. You were wounded 5 times in the war. After the march was over, you were still a prisoner of war for another 3.5 years before you were liberated, wasting away to 68 pounds by the time you were liberated, from 180 to 68, if you're listening at home and can just imagine what that must be like. I know it's the obvious answer to the question, did you ever think you were going to die, was yes. You probably had to think about that every day. But what was it that kept you going and that kept you believing that you might be able to make it home and marry and have a family and have the kind of life that you were fighting to preserve?
Well, I didn't have no fancy thoughts about marrying or anything like that. I worried whether or not I'd ever get through and survive. That was the main consideration. And under the circumstances, it was a pretty hard row. You wonder what made me keep going and whatnot. Well, later on, we got into some barracks and whatnot. I seen guys actually more or less commit suicide because they couldn't take it until they picked us up and sent us by ship to Mukden, Manchuria. There we got a little better consideration because they put us in, most of us, in the tool and die factory where they made the tools for machinery or plane parts or anything. Everybody, 100% of us, sabotaged everything. And they had guards right over us, and we'd put filings in the oil, and all kinds of stuff.
It had been years since I'd listened back to that interview with Bataan Death March survivor Wild Bill Begley, but the will to survive and to foil the enemy at every opportunity, even while wasting away to skin and bones, it leaves such a powerful impression. There was one more thought that Bill shared when I asked him why he spent decades traveling up and down California as part of a military honor guard for countless burials of veterans.
Well, when we got to O'Donnell, the first prisoner of war camp, the guys were dying so fast, it was terrible. The ones that were standing and able to walk and to carry somebody, we'd get a door off of a hut, and four of us get on it. Many times before we got to the hole in the ground where we'd have to throw them in there, maybe half of the guys, and I've seen as many as four of the stretcher bearers, would die en route. It was pretty tough.
It is just unbelievable to imagine how these courageous men persevered amidst those conditions. But every Death March survivor I've talked to echoes a similar storyline. And that includes those from New Mexico, which had more men on the march than any other state in the Union. One of them was a man named Julio Barella. And even before the march started, things had gotten pretty bleak for Julio. He and his fellow members of the 200th Coast Artillery in the Philippines were undersupplied, ill-equipped, and had no hope of reinforcements.
We don't surrender until we run out of everything. We were starving, eating weeds and stuff like that in order to survive. And there's where the death march started.
Now, when you started that march, you had no idea how long it was going to go. And you're already starving, right?
When we started that death march pretty weak. We were pretty weak then because when we were fighting, we didn't have enough to eat. First thing, we were getting only two meals a day, and then they cut us to one meal a day. And then after that, we didn't have anything to eat. So,
what kept you going? How did you continue on? Because I'm sure a lot of guys were falling by the side and probably getting shot or bayoneted, and you were seeing guys fall left and right. What kept you going? How do you think you survived?
To survive? Well, we used to hunt, we used to eat weeds and stuff like that. Then a lot of them died with malaria, and a lot of them with diarrhea, according to what they eat, see. And part of them died in the death march, and then the other part died in concentration camp.
Did you ever think that you were going to die?
I thought I was going to die, but I just got to where I didn't care. It was just like this. See, I used to worry a lot about my folks, about my mother. I used to worry every day. And one day I said to myself, why, hell, I'm nothing but a doggone stupid. I'm not going to worry about them because they're better off than I am. They're not having as much trouble as I am having. And the other boys, they feel the same way. We got to where we forgot all about our folks and about the living life. Maybe we were just lucky because when they surrendered, a lot of them died of starvation. A lot of them, they didn't have anything to eat. They were weak, malaria, dysentery, and all that. A lot of disease. Well, we got to where we didn't care. We used to help the ones that couldn't walk. By the Japanese, the ones that couldn't walk, they shoot them. When a man lay down and he can't get up, why, they shoot him. So if they were punish you when you were in concentration camp, they punish me and they knock me down. And then I have in mind that if I try to stand up and get up, I won't be killed. So, see, that's a lesson the hard way.
I'll say that's a great way to put it, learning the hard way indeed. And every survivor of the death march that I've interviewed over the years has told me really the same thing that you just did. No one knows exactly how many people died on the march. I've seen estimates of around 10,000 or so. And who knows how many died later because of what they went through on the march. But I know that you Americans helped each other, and you got a lot of help from the Filipinos, who, from what I've seen statistically, outnumbered Americans on the march about 7-1. But all of you were not only marching 61 miles through deep layers of dust, you really didn't have any kind of nourishment. How bad was it? How bad in terms of what you had to eat and drink?
They make us wait 3 days before they could start giving us a bowl of rice, just how much I can grab on a bowl of rice. And that's when the death march starts. They start walking without water. And then in concentration camps, we were there starving all the time that we were in prison camp. We never did get anything much to eat. And they were Filipinos. They would try to help us, give us food. They find out that that Filipino tried to help POWs. They would shoot them or burn their kids, burn their homes. They act like they were not civilized. We never have a dream that we was going to survive. We never thought we was going to make it.
Do you remember how much you weighed before?
I weighed about 145, 150. I never been very heavy. But when I was liberated, I weighed 83 pounds.
Your liberation. You survived the march to Camp O'Donnell. You'd been in another infamous camp at Cabanatuan. They took you over to Japan on a hell ship. And in late August of 1945, the atomic bombs had been dropped. The war was coming to an end. And finally, your camp at Niigata, Japan, was liberated. What do you remember about that? What do you remember about tasting freedom again for the first time in more than 3.5 years?
We're very, very weak. Our mind was very weak, and our bodies very weak. We couldn't hardly do much work. We just hope and pray that someday the war will be over. We were working in a foundry. They never gave us a day off, so we noticed that it was a surprise to us. That the Japanese said that we were going to get 3 days off, that we have to stay in camp. So we were anxious to hear the Japanese commander telling us that we have surrendered. And the American officer asked the Japanese, what happened? Nothing. You people won the war. The war is over. Now you people take over tonight. What the Japanese told the American commander, you take care of your prisoners, not to go out because they're going to get killed, because the Japanese don't like the American prisoners, and they're going to get killed if they go out of the camp. So better stay in the camp, so we stay there, you know, until the next day. And then the next day, they go three planes, and they drop us leaflets, saying that if we would clear the area, they will drop packages.
So they dropped some leaflets. They said, get out of the way. We don't want to kill you with the food we want to drop for you. And then you finally got to go outside of the walls of that camp. You'd been living in, I would imagine, and you've described what would be a bleak, seemingly hopeless world for so long, only praying that you'd make it out alive. So not to be too cliched, but did it feel like a dream come true or a prayer answered when you got to come home? What did that feel like?
Well, we had plenty to eat. Every place we go, we just give us something to eat and stuff like that. And it was pretty hard to tell the whole story about it. And I don't know. And some people, well, the prisoners of war I have talked to, they feel the same way that I feel. They didn't want to talk about it. They got to where they didn't want to talk about it. That's funny. We do more talking now than we did before. We never did say anything because everywhere we go, we start asking us how many Japanese did we kill and all that. None.
Let me ask you this. How often do you think about the other prisoners of war who didn't get to come home? Do you ever think about that, about all the guys who died over there?
Oh, I dream more about them than I dream about my people, even today. Every day I remember about some of the prisoners.
Do you ever think that could have been you? Do you ever think about the, you know, how you could have died there?
Yeah, surprises me that I made it. I sometimes don't even believe it. Being so long and I've getting old and all that, I sometimes don't believe it. I'm made it. I don't believe it. I went through all that.
The late Julio Barella, one of more than 1,800 soldiers from the state of New Mexico who endured the Bataan Death March. Only half of them would make it home. It's time for our final break, but there's much more to come, including how one Filipino soldier miraculously escaped the Death March. Hometown Heroes will be right back after this. I always love hearing from listeners, and so many of you tell me you listen to Hometown Heroes while you're on the road. Nobody spends more time on the road than our friends in the trucking business. And if that's your business, I'm sure you know about Central Valley Trailer Repair. If you don't, you really should. Conveniently located near California's major transportation arteries, CVTR has stockpiles of parts waiting for you in Fresno and in Stockton, with experienced service technicians ready to handle even the most difficult of repairs. Central Valley Trailer Repair is an authorized Great Dane sales, parts, and service center, and you can always find a huge inventory of new and used semi-trailers for sale too. Dry freight, refrigerated, flatbed, whatever you're looking for, CVTR has you covered. How about 24-hour emergency service? You bet. What can't CVTR help you with? That's a question I can't answer, so you'll have to ask them yourself at 1-800-877-8444. That's 1-800-877-8444. The website, that's simple, cvtr.com. For Central Valley Trailer Repair, and tell them you heard about them on Hometown Heroes.
Honoring veterans from sea to shining sea. You're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler, brought to you by this local station and its sponsors, and presented everywhere, on the air and online, by Provident Payments, one of the fastest-growing payment consultants in America. Connect today at providentpayments.com.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes. It has been 80 years now since the Bataan Death March, a chapter of history that many today have simply never heard of. And what better way to learn about it than to hear the memories of those who survived it? Some of what they witnessed was very difficult to talk about and very difficult to believe, as we hear in the memories of Ben Ciccone of the 194th Tank Battalion.
At first, when I come home, I had nothing else to talk to but a prison camp, you know, going 5 years. And then after a while, people started looking at me kind of funny. And my brother said, I wasn't talking much anymore. I said, well, everybody looks at me though I'm lying or something. And I just didn't care about talking about it. But a lot of days, I don't remember what happened on a march. And they say I was a survivor. And one of the longest, too, by the way, where I was caught. You see, that's why what you read in history, they say 55, 60 miles. Well, I went over 100 miles, and it took me 13 days because on the wrong side of the island. I had my platoon. We were supposed to counterattack and then cut across and get on the easy road back, but I started back. The Japanese had artillery set up there, so I had no choice but to back up. When I got there, they started the march. I was running the tail end. That's why it was 13 days. It was most of 5, 7, 8 days. If I could have crossed the island, then I'd have been a lot better. And along the march, I don't know how many days we were on it, but he got us all out. He put us on the field. Well, in comes a sharp. He graduates from the University of California, or Southern California. Born ways here. He called us every dirty, rotten name he could, some I didn't even know about. Made us take our hats off and sit out in that sun with no water or nothing for about 8, 9 hours. And he called us every dirty name. Well, we lost 10,000 men on the march and dead all over the place. But as far as food, we had a rice ball along the way. But you're talking about 2 weeks. I had another buddy, and we couldn't go any further, so we fell out. But lucky, I don't know how long I was there, 2 or 3 days. And finally, some guy striking telephone wire, and he hit us, and of course, the guy had to get the hell out and back in the highway again. So we had to go. We got in the highway, waiting for the stragglers, and couldn't find out. It was only a couple of miles where we ended up, but there was about 50. And when we got in this place with a number of maggots and dead people, next morning, there was only 8 alive, and the rest were just dead. The last stop, we took a break. We were just dead tired. We were off the road, and there was a Filipino. I gave him a little water, but he died. So we flopped down, and then they said the Jap guards were covered up. So we just stayed there and played dead. Thank God the guy next to me was dead. they just hit us with a rifle and just kept on going.
What happened after that?
We finally got up and joined the trek again. You had to get out on the road. If they caught you, they would kill you.
And thousands upon thousands died, whether that way or otherwise. In fact, an accurate estimate of just how many died is still elusive because of the way it all unfolded. But you're facing the prospect of dying from starvation or from exhaustion, by cruelty at the hand of your captors, and in all likelihood, you're never going to see your wife and kids again.
My wife waited 3 years before she even knew I was alive. My wife had to go to work. I had two children and a grandmother living with her. So my wife, lucky she's a college graduate, she got a job, and then she worked in theater at nights, and then she done some waitress work on Saturday night. She went to the Army, you know, I haven't got any money. My husband's as a prisoner of war, you know. Oh, no, he's missing an accident. Well, we got to have something from your husband. You know, what a silly thing to tell my wife. So she had to go home and nobody gave her nothing. Took her 8 months before she got a dime. The Japanese put out a propaganda that I was being held. Then she heard the official word was just a month before I was liberated. I wasn't liberated, I liberated myself.
And we want to hear about the liberation, but before we get to that, I understand you were 174 pounds when you got to the Philippines, that on the march you got down to about half of that. But one of the things that helped you gain back a little bit of that weight after the march is that you actually befriended some of your captors?
I made friends. As a matter of fact, my life was saved by this Nagano-san up there. I went to Japan to see him. And if it wasn't for him, like I tell you, in May, it took most of my men I could find. It took us 3 hours to walk about 100 yards to get on this truck. If you get on the truck, you'd go into detail. And they took about 300 of us. Then the next day we went on, they stopped the convoy. 150 went on ahead, and 150 of us stayed in this little town of Kalawan. And lucky, there's where we had a Japanese captain, a professor at the University of Tokyo, spoke English. And he gives a talk that told us we fought a good war, we had to obey his laws, and there was no other way. And he would take care of us, or feed us, till we could go to war. He called in doctors, had the Filipinos bring us meat and food. We didn't have to do anything for 2 weeks if it wasn't for him. And then I got the job working in the kitchen, and this Nagano-san, the one up there, took a liking to me. He took care of me like I was a baby, I guess. Made give me sugar, smokes, and everything. So for 2 weeks, we didn't do anything. And if it wasn't for that, we'd all die.
So
Now, let me tell you, the rest of the 150 that went above us, only 8 survived that. We were lucky, that whole group, that 150 of us. We lost 7, and they would have died anyway. They were too sick to start with. But if it wasn't for them, and like I say, that Nagano-san, he helped save all our lives there, not only me. Then the story goes on for years.
Yeah, and you actually went and found him in Japan 8 years after the war and thanked him?
When I found out he was alive, we went to Tokyo. And I were at the Imperial Hotel. When I got downstairs, right in the early part of the evening, I spotted him with the stuff in his hands. He spotted me, put our arms around each other and cried. In Japan now. That's something else.
The late Ben Sacconi. I'll never forget him telling me that he planned to burn the diaries he had kept from some of his fellow Bataan Death March survivors because some of the contents were so severe and so extreme they shouldn't be seen by anyone. We're up to 4 American servicemen whose memories of the march we've heard today, but there were far more Filipinos involved and far more Filipinos who died as a result of the march. Adelano David was one of thousands of Filipinos to sign up for American military service before the war.
We were grossly underprepared. Our rifles were too large for the Filipino. To sight the barrel, we had to put the heavy stock on our shoulders, and every time we fired, it bruised our shoulders. And most of the time, because the equipment came from World War I, some of them probably were not properly cleaned or they were just obsolete. They exploded in our faces and we had casualties. So the first engagement against the Japanese was a fiasco because we had exploding bombs, rifles. Our machine gun and mortar shells didn't explode. They were duds. So against a veteran army and really... From Nanking and from Manchuria, And we were, most of our men were farmers and clerks. And some of us didn't even know how to handle a rifle. So we had to retreat from the beach defense to Agno River on North Luzon while we didn't have any more air cover. We lost 350 scouts on the first engagement in Agno River out of 800 because they, on horseback, they fought against tanks.
And these are the stories so many people are unaware of, and I'm so thankful we have you to clue us in a little bit. Were there rumblings of the surrender before it happened, before General King said, yep, this is it?
No, it was a total surprise. Well, most of us cried because we didn't want to surrender. And then when the order came to surrender, a lot of us were still fighting. In spite of the order to surrender, they were bombing us anyway. We were on the last defense on Mount Samad. We lost practically all of our 33rd Infantry was wiped out on Samad. And when I came to me to surrender, I had a choice of going into the mountains because there was a rumor that we could go instead of surrendering. But we couldn't because if we surrendered, anybody who surrendered was shot anyway. They had orders to kill all prisoners. As a matter of fact, there's a record in the books which says the first surrenderers were about 300 mixed U.S. Army and the Philippine Army. They were massacred, 300 of them, and they had surrendered.
I can't imagine what that feels like to be in a situation where you have to make that decision. And you had family to worry about too, right?
Yes, I had a girlfriend who was waiting, and I didn't know where she was. She didn't know where I was. My father didn't even know I was in the Army because I didn't tell him.
What do you think led you to decide what you decided, and how scary and frightening was that?
We decided to surrender because if we went to the mountains, we were blocked anyway, and we could be captured anyway. But when we surrendered, a lot of us went away to the hills, including Colonel Torpy, who became the guerrilla leader in Zambales Mountains. When I escaped from the death march, that's what I joined. When we first surrendered, we were lined up. Anybody found with Japanese money, paper money, or anything, or a sword, or as a souvenir, or anything that has a Japanese marking, the owner, the soldier who had it, was usually beheaded or beaten up. On my own, they tried to take my watch and my military ring, and I objected. And when I objected, the soldier hit me with the butt of his rifle in the belly and on my shins. So I fell down on my knees, and I was so angry I was going to retaliate when I got up. But a buddy of mine held me back. He said, don't howl, it's going to kill you because they've done that. And when we gathered together in groups of 100, sometimes groups of 50, to start us on the march. On the march, even before I got too far from the site of surrender, I saw already bodies on the road, bayoneted. And these are not soldiers who were fighting, but they were sick, too sick to go on with malaria, dysentery. That's when I began to lose hope. I said, oh, I'm going to die. Then in the next town, if I have a chance, I'll die trying to escape or escape. And I did that.
So how far into the march was that? How many days?
One day. So when I escaped, at first what my buddies were trying to do was, because I could not stand up anymore, and they could not carry me anymore. I had malaria and dysentery and a shrapnel wound, and I was fainting. So he said, the next chance we have, you better go. When we saw the Japanese away from the guarding us, I tried to escape through the bushes, but they suddenly jerked me back, and they said, I'll wait for another chance. At this point, I decided to die marching because I was scared for some reason or other. No, I got scared. when they saw a gap a few miles afterwards, they saw a gap. They pushed me through the bushes, and I fell across the bushes into a trench dug out by the Filipino occupants of the house by the road. And they covered me with banana leaves and bamboo leaves.
So you get pushed by your friends, who've already saved your life a couple times, it sounds like, by holding you back from retaliating and then telling you not to escape them. They push you into the bushes, you fall into this trench, and you're so weak you don't even know what to do, but these occupants of the house come down and cover you?
I was out for a while because I was sick and thirsty and starving. When I woke up, I was already in the house, and they nursed me for 3 days. On the fourth day, I told them that I had to go, and they pointed me. They gave me a map where to join the rest of the group. Apparently, they had help other people. Many soldiers escaped through the same, so they knew where to go.
And, you know, there are so many great stories about the war in Europe, and we hear about, you know, the Corrie Ten Booms of the world and the Anne Frank situation or Oskar Schindler and these people that protected some of the Jews. And we don't hear so many stories about the Pacific, but really these people risked their lives to save yours. How did that make you feel? How indebted did you feel to those folks?
Lifetime, but when I came back, I was back into the MacArthur Liberation Army. I looked for them, but they had moved away already. I know their last names, De La Cruz, but up to now I've not been able to contact them.
And it sounds like you've spent some time trying.
This is the same time I was looking for my sweetheart, and because they had gone to the hills and I didn't know where. So it took me a while to finally give up. So when I finally found where she was home in Manila.
And a lot happened in between there. Is there any question in your mind that if you hadn't escaped at that point, that you would have survived or not? What do you think would have happened?
I would have died on the way, because on the way there were cattle cars where we were going to be confined. It was a cow car where only 100 could be, and they were jam-packed. They could not even sit down. I probably would have died of starvation and thirst on the way, or malaria or dysentery. Because it was from where I escaped, it was another 30 miles. I would like to remember the young people my age who died unnecessarily, because if Japan listened to the peace treaties and the wishes of the Japanese people, a million Filipinos should not have died. So I would like to remember it as an episode in the Philippine history which should not have happened. It's important for me because I lost a lot of friends my age. I also lost a brother-in-law who was killed by the Japanese brutally. And a lot of people suffering during the Japanese occupation. People who are happy, peace-loving people. Suddenly they were in the middle of brutality and killings that were not necessary.
The Bataan Death March, 80 years ago, a tragic end for so many, the prelude to death in captivity for many more, but a story of survival for the five men whose memories we heard today, five men who dedicated the rest of their time on this planet to honoring those who did not make it home. Head over to hometownheroesradio.com for links to the original full-length interviews with each one of them, and also for information on organizations dedicated to keeping the history of the Bataan Death March alive. Thanks for listening to Hometown Heroes today. I'm Paul Leffler, reminding you again that freedom is not free.
To let Paul know about a veteran in your life, visit hometownheroesradio.com and click on Suggest a Veteran. Today's program has been brought to you by Provident Payments. Give your business the edge only their personalized service can deliver at providentpayments.com.
If you're a business owner, I've got a phone number you really ought to take down, 800-989-1139. And when I say business owner, I mean businesses of all shapes and sizes, from the multinational chain to the hot dog stand on the corner, or my personal preference, the taco truck, 800-989-1139. Because you can have the greatest product or service in the world, the best business plan, the most capable workforce, and still not maximize your potential if you don't have a reliable, efficient, and versatile plan for processing payments. 800-989-1139. That's the number for my friends at Provident Payments, one of the fastest-growing payment consultants in the country. Why is Provident growing so fast? Because they're committed to helping your business grow. 800-989-1139. That nonprofit you love that relies on donations? Provident can even connect you to a special software platform to streamline and stimulate giving. If you are ready to grow, give it a go. Go Provident today at ProvidentPayments.com or call that number, 800-989-1139.